Hello and welcome to another episode of The Partial Historians. I am Dr. Rad and I am once again flying solo because I am here to read another bonus chapter from the book that Dr. G and I have just written for you today. We have just been working on Your Cheeky Guide to the Roman Empire, which is a humorous exploration of many, many topics all about Rome. Everything from aqueducts to the greatest love affairs of the Roman Empire. And we actually wrote too much, which is why I have some fabulous chapters to share with you all. This is from the bonus section, which is going to be on the Ulysses Press website, which is all about the rebels of Rome, called With a Rebel Yell. Last time I told you all about Spartacus, but this time I'm going to tell you all about Zenobia. Zenobia's winning strategy. Many of the rebels that pop up in the history of Rome are what you might call classic rebels. You know, little guys taking on the imperial machine, fighting to overthrow the system, break out of this prison cell. If you look at our stories of Masada and Spartacus, you can see the connection. Our final example is an exception to this rule. Get ready for the amazing tale of Septimia Zenobia. Zenobia became famous, or infamous, for declaring herself empress during the troubles of the 3rd century CE. She went from the consort of the most important man in Palmyra to regent for their son, to empress, to exalted exile in Rome. However, the origins of this rebellious minx are largely unknown. Much like Spartacus, we know precious little about the early life of Zenobia, or Bat-Zabai, her Palmyrene Aramaic name. Who bothers to keep track of women and enslaved people? They're so clearly unimportant. Even when Zenobia stepped into the spotlight, the source material for her life is massively dodgy, patchy, and downright unreliable. The main source is the Historia Augusta. But as always, we shall press bravely on into the darkness and do the best we can. She was born around 240 CE in Palmyra, a very ancient city located in the province of Syria, which probably meant she had Aramaic and Arabic roots. This meant that she was born during one of the lowest points for the empire, when emperors were as disposable as yesterday's newspaper. Seriously. 238 CE has been dubbed the Year of the Six Emperors. It was a PW, a personal worst. To add to the internal chaos, external pressures were coming from multiple directions. The Goths and the Huns at the borders of Gaul and Dacia, the Alemanni on the frontiers of Germania, and the Sasanians causing problems along the eastern border. Throw in a plague and you've got yourself a political crisis. Ah, it's positively reminiscent of America in 2020 to 2021. Emperors could not hope to fix all of these problems at once, especially since they were working in 24-hour shifts. The parts of the empire that seemed most at risk absorbed their attention. As for the rest, the grasp of the central government became looser, and paperwork was at the bottom of the to-do list. This could be dangerous if some ambitious general was able to convince the local legions that he could be the next big thing. Imperial ambitions. The province of Syria was hot property, and both the Romans and Sasanians wanted it to be in their club. And not just because size matters when it comes to empires, it also had desirable trade routes. The Romans were therefore lucky that the most powerful man in a significant city like Palmyra was incredibly loyal. Odenathus, or Odenath in Aramaic, was rich, politically influential, and a talented military general from a noble family in Palmyra. An ancient triple threat. His family had been granted citizenship early in the 3rd century, and not long after, everyone else was too, thanks to a law passed in 212 CE. As the Romans could no longer use citizenship as a reward, Odenathus had been granted senatorial status. Just the status. He did not actually go to the meetings. Jackpot! At some point, in around 257-58 CE, he was upgraded to consular status. With that card in his back pocket, almost no one in Syria had higher status than him. That ought to keep him interested in this system, right? Who would be the lucky lady to snag this highly eligible bachelor? A knockout 17 or 18-year-old named Zenobia, that's who. This might have been a May-December match, although we can't be sure about Odenathus's age. He was old enough to have a fully grown son named Herodian from his previous wife, but age gaps are not unusual in ancient marriages. Not long after their marriage, Rome was rocked by one of the worst defeats it had ever endured, the capture of the Emperor Valerian during the war with the Persians. See Chapter 1, Armed and Dangerous, for more on that. All we need to know is that this disaster left Rome exposed. Syria was under attack. It's Odenathus and Zenobia to the rescue! Whilst the exact details are iffy, it seemed that Odenathus assumed control of the armed forces and the government in Palmyra, and possibly much further. He was putting out fires left and right. Persian king on the rampage? Piece of cake. Usurpers? No problem. Lost the province of Mesopotamia? Forget about it. The shocking thing about all of his success in this context is that Odenathus did not try to claim imperial power for himself. However, there was no doubt that Zenobia had hitched her wagon to the right star, as Odenathus's stock only went up due to these efforts. He may have been awarded a title that meant something like Restorer of the East because he had done such a bang-up job fighting the Persians, or some sort of impressive official position. It would be super helpful to know exactly where he was active, but we just can't be sure. Odenathus may have been overseeing multiple provinces, or it might have just been Palmyra. Wherever he roamed, the honours received gave him enviable status. Odenathus's continued campaigns against the Persians led to him dubbing himself and his eldest son King of Kings, a title used in the Persian Empire. If this sounds suspiciously grand, just remember that by taking a Persian title, Odenathus was taking aim at their king, not the Roman emperor. This was a challenge to the east. Together with Herodian, Odenathus held sway in the eastern provinces with the blessing of the very busy Roman emperor, and Zenobia was right by his side, even accompanying him on campaign, which won her much admiration. Zenobia steps into the breach. The good times did not last. Odenathus and Herodian were suddenly assassinated in around 267 to 268 CE, and our sources are extremely uncertain about who done it. Was it a petty dispute taken way too far? Was it the Sasanian king Shapur? Was it Zenobia, perhaps scheming for her own son with Odenathus? Was it a jealous emperor? We'll have to leave this one for Nancy Drew to solve one day. Whoever it was left Zenobia and her son conspicuously alive. The last thing this area needed was another power vacuum. Zenobia threw herself and her son into the vortex. You may think, well, that makes sense. Her son, Vabalathus, or Wabalath in Aramaic, was the oldest heir left standing. She may have had more children with Odenathus, but as Zenobia only mentions one, we'll assume she had one and was done. However, it was not a given that this child would step into his father's much larger sandals. The emperor got to make that call. Not in Zenobia's world. She was living her best life, which was imagining that she could be regent for Vabalathus in a somewhat autonomous client kingdom that encompassed the provinces of Syria and Mesopotamia. Her son was given Odonathus's titles and Zenobia assumed his powers. But of course, we aren't sure what those were. Perhaps she stuck to the more Eastern titles, which wouldn't annoy Rome and were from a tradition which was more accepting of hereditary power. Actions might speak louder than words. We know that Zenobia quickly started receiving official delegations. She surrounded herself with capable men, including Cassius Longinus, who was a philosopher, rhetorician, and tutored her son, and some generals, Septimius Zabdas and Septimius Zabai. How did the Romans feel about all this? They may not have minded at first. Odonathus' death threatened the tenuous stability of the East. If they were worried, once again, there were just more pressing issues to address. The Emperor Gallienus had been assassinated at a similar time to Odonathus and Herodian. His successor, Claudius II, or Claudius Gothicus, was tied up fighting the Goths in Serbia and the Alemanni in Italy. Zenobia might be a concern, but she wasn't a barbarian horde. There's also no evidence that Zenobia immediately interfered in the normal government of the provinces. Governors were still appointed, taxes were still collected. Zenobia may have been concerned with more of the big picture stuff, like that pesky Persian threat. Zenobia continued to campaign against the Parthians in 269 CE, which included an overhaul on some fortresses along the Euphrates. She started using the title Persicus Maximus for her son Vabalathus, a Roman way of recognising success in battle. Claudius II also adopted the title of Parthicus Maximus at this time. He definitely was not fighting the Sasanians, so either this title was his way of showing Zenobia who was boss, or they were in cahoots. Regardless of their relationship, Claudius was carried off by plague the following year. This was a total shock and led to even more internal problems. The Senate had chosen Claudius's brother as the next emperor, but the legion stations on the Danube had other ideas. Whilst they were busy securing the throne for Aurelian, Zenobia thought to herself, would the Romans really notice if I took Arabia? With astonishing speed and efficiency, Zenobia and her army of 70,000 men captured Arabia. This was a break from the role that she and her husband had previously played, where they were kind of like emperor assistants. But taking a province without asking, not only is that rude, but it's a sure way to look aggressively expansionist. Just ask Hitler. Zenobia had no intention of stopping with Arabia. Wealthy Egypt would be a real feather in her cap. It had always held a special place for emperors. Once again, she was able to seize control with relative ease, and by December of 270 CE, she posed a real threat as she controlled the supply of vital resources and revenue. To be blunt, she had the empire by the balls. Previously, while she was battling with the Persian Empire, she had not prevented the usual imperial business, like the collection of taxes or the production of coins for Gallienus and Claudius II at the mint in Antioch. Now we start to see coins that feature Aurelian and Vabalathus. Some designs position him on the reverse, which would imply he was the junior ruler, but others from Antioch show Vabalathus on the obverse. Even though Zenobia did replace the Roman governor that she had killed during the takeover with another one, and she was not cutting Egypt off from the rest of the empire, her actions were too concerning to overlook anymore. Aurelian had to tear himself away from the Goths that were skipping all over the province of Dacia. What was Zenobia trying to do? What did she think would happen? It would be a lie to say we knew what her goals were with any certainty. However, it does not seem like Zenobia was initially trying to take down the empire, nor was she attempting to take Aurelian's place. It seems more likely that Zenobia was staking a claim to power in her corner of the world and secure prosperity for her people. This was no comfort to Aurelian, of course. Oh, you just want a slice of imperial pie? Now that Zenobia was in the sights of Aurelian and his legions, the pressure was on. In typical Zenobia fashion, she opted to commit fully to a power grab. What the hell? I'll take the whole damn pie for my son and myself. Vabalathus and Zenobia were crowned as Augustus and Augusta in Alexandria. Coins were produced with Vabalathus on the obverse and unambiguous titles like Victorious Augustus and Eternal Augustus. Both Zenobia and Vabalathus had coins issued that connected them to traditional gods of Roman power, such as Jupiter and Juno. Message received, guys! The jig is up. Team Zenobia decided to prepare for battle in Antioch, so they removed their troops from Egypt and Arabia. Just temporarily, or so they thought. Unluckily for them, after a run of underachievers before him, Aurelian was an exceptionally capable leader. Charisma? Check. Nerve? Check. Talent? Check. He secured victory over Zenobia in three battles. After 16 months, her play for ultimate power was over. In 272 CE, Zenobia was caught as she tried to make a run for it. She may have been hoping that as long as she was free, she could regroup. As crazy as it seems, we can't be certain about what happened to Zenobia. She may have died not long after she was taken prisoner, but most of the sources think she survived. Zenobia was put on trial for her attempted usurpation. Whilst Cassius Longinus was executed and General Zabdas dropped out of the records, Zenobia did not have to pay the ultimate price. She apparently wept and pointed the finger at the men around her. She would never have rebelled against Aurelian on her own. They fell for it. Well, Aurelia did tend to be a forgiving kind of guy. Zenobia had to appear in Aurelian's triumph as his star prisoner. But after that, she was set up with a house and a stipend. She was exiled from Palmyra forever, but got to live as a citizen in Rome until her death. It is unclear what happened to her son, but there are hints in the sources that he survived this final showdown. Her other children, that may or may not have been fictional, possibly joined her in Rome. Cleopatra 2.0. Usually, women in power in the Roman world got royally trashed in the source material. A boy without a winkle trying to run things? Absurd. However, the super problematic Historia Augusta has sections that are often quite positive about Zenobia. She is portrayed as a gorgeous, wise, strong leader, able to be merciful, but also to use a little muscle when needed. It's tricky to know how genuine this is, as it may be a ploy to shape the way we see the emperors. Aurelian could look even more glorious because he was victorious against this modern-day Cleopatra VII, and Gallienus would look terrible because a woman was a better ruler than him in almost every respect. True, once you get into the life of Aurelian section, things take a sharp turn for the worse, but at least she gets a moment. Zenobia's life reveals much about her time. It would have been much harder for her family to rise to such heights in a less troublesome period. However, the fact that she and her husband saw themselves as elite Romans as well as Palmyrians and were invested in working within the Roman system makes her a different kind of rebel. What she does have in common with Spartacus and the rebels of Masada is that her story has often been told by her enemy and reimagined to suit later generations. In Zenobia's case, these interpretations span the globe and can be found in Anglophone and Arab nations. And that was our chapter from With a Rebel Yell on Queen Zenobia. If you're interested in learning more, we suggest that you check out Nathaniel Andrade's Zenobia, the Shooting Star of Palmyra, Pat Southern's Empress Zenobi, Palmyra's Rebel Queen, or Emma Southern's A History of the Roman Empire in 21 Women. So if you enjoyed that little excerpt, then please, if you're listening before November the 4th, go and pre-order yourself a copy of Your Cheeky Guide to the Roman Empire. And if you're listening after November 4, then please grab yourself a copy, either on Amazon or from your local independent bookseller. All the details about it can be found on our website, or you can head over to Ulysses Press. Thanks so much for listening, guys. And until next time, We are yours in ancient Rome.